Okay, welcome back to Southern Alberta Council of Public Affairs. And I hope you enjoyed your lunch and that you have questions ready. I neglected to mention to you that Melanie Thomas is the Lethbridge federal NDP candidate for the upcoming election. All right, let's welcome Melanie back to answer your questions.
Inspiring, depressing, but informative presentation.
Thank you.
I was wondering, Melanie, if any of the studies that you've done have looked at how women view women in politics.
We've looked at it a little bit. It's a little bit more hard to get at because we don't exactly have a specific measure. Normally we get around actually asking direct questions, how do you feel about a certain particular group, because of a problem with surveys called social desirability. So when people are presented with a very direct question, how do you feel about women, how do you feel about Aboriginal people, those sorts of things, they'll respond in a way that they feel is more socially desirable rather than what actually reflects their own opinion. And we find that with the election study with voter turnout, when people are asked if they voted in the election, apparently in Canada voter turnout is in the 80% range, according to the election study. So we know that people lie a little bit on survey questions. So when we look at things like support for we'll look at things like support for feminism and things like that instead. There aren't really significant gender differences, and I suspect it's more because of the social desirability problem with survey research instead of actual opinion. That said, some of my colleagues have done work looking to see if at the local level having a woman as a candidate helps engage local women, and in some places it does, in other places it doesn't. For the Bloc, surprisingly, it had a very negative effect. So really, we're looking at it, but we can't really say for sure. Yeah.
Hi, Melanie.
Hi.
Say, if we go according to your speech, my name is Linda Eagley. If we go according to your speech, what you personally are doing is a total oxymoron. Now, the question I have for you is, what or who influenced you the most to enter politics?
There are two answers for that. I was always fairly interested in the political system, and I think that was mostly due to my mom. I mean, my mom was a registered nurse, and when I was small, there was the illegal Wildcat nurses strike, and I remember visiting her on the picket line and actually cluing into the fact that there was something that was going on that wasn't quite right. People were upset about something, and they were taking a political action to that. Also, I remember being in rural Alberta where we didn't have cable television and only three channels. When the 92 Conservative Leader Convention came on, I ended up watching that. And I don't know if it's because I was actually interested in politics or there was nothing else to do and I really didn't want to go read a book or something, and I ended up just watching TV. So that's what actually got me into political science and to actually be engaged and active at a more esoteric level in politics. But when it came to actually running, my friend Shannon Phillips, I had worked with her in student politics. I should back up. What got me interested in student politics was I had heard that the student board of governors representative had actually voted in favor of a tuition increase, and that made me really angry. So that's why I got into student politics. For federal politics, though, my friend Shannon was working with the University of Alberta Students Union and about to leave that position to be the Alberta organizer for the federal NDP for the 2004 election. And she suggested in about September 2003 to me, why don't you run in Lethbridge? I think you'd be a really good candidate. And I'll be honest, my initial response was, are you kidding me? No. I mean, I had just been out of my degree for 2.5 months, I think, because I ended up finishing all my coursework in July. So I hadn't been out of university very long. And she just ended up working on me and working on me and working on me until by December I had agreed to be the candidate and was nominated that following January. Now, my mom, being a very, it's interesting looking at her example because she dug her heels in much deeper than what I did. She's always been very active with her union, paid attention a lot to politics, particularly with the Ralph Klein government and the cuts to healthcare, being a frontline healthcare worker. And we actually had her on the list to be called by Jack Layton because she wouldn't listen to any of us. We finally said, okay, if she gets a random call from the leader of the party, she'll probably be more willing to put her name on the ballot. But we got her before Jack had to call. But like when it comes to actual formal politics, like pretty much every other woman that I know, I had to be asked and I had to be prodded and I had to be pushed into in a little bit.
Okay, now you alluded to that in your speech that parents have a big influence on women as far as being involved. Mm-hmm. And you're saying basically the same thing now. Have you done any studies at all to the possibility that the breakdown of the family is also part of this problem of women not wanting to be involved?
Based on the tools that I've got at my disposal, I don't think I can get at that. We ask, with the election study, we do ask questions if people are married or divorced or single and never been married, how many children they have and the like, but we don't actually ask their kids. And so it's not exactly in vogue, and it hasn't been for quite some time, to actually do political survey-type research for anybody under the age of 18. And so I don't know, really, and I wouldn't even know. I don't have the tools to actually go about actually answering that question. Theoretically, I don't even think there's anything in political science that would point us in any direction on that either. So
I don't want to hog the mic, but I have another question. Not only is it an oxymoron that you are in politics,
yeah,
but you are in politics in Southern Alberta from the NDP party, and you see here today, you have a very engaged audience, mm-hmm, who are 60 or over, and so I'm just wondering, why do you think that people are interested in listening to you, Melanie?
Oh dear.
Somebody just said you're cute.
It's amazing. Every time I go to a high school, during the high school election forums, that was always the first question. I would go, we were in Cartston on a Friday, and the first question was, what are you doing tonight? And, you know, and they didn't actually have the guts to say that into a microphone and ask for an answer, because I certainly would have given them one. But I don't know. I think when you come to formal politics, particularly candidates, it's a novelty to have somebody who is young run. And typically when you've got a young person who's running, they are a young man. They're not a young woman. So I know that being a young woman who's engaged in the public side of politics, that's a bit of a novelty, and I think that would attract, I know that actually does attract people to it as well. I'd like to think that I was competent and that people liked listening to me because I know what I'm talking about. But other than that, sometimes it is still a little bit of a mystery to me, but the way that I approach it is that I know what I know about policy and I know what I know about political science, and if that can actually, people can actually take that information and use it politically in their own political actions, then that's a good thing.
And do you see a future for yourself in politics?
Oh, thanks, Linda.
Okay.
Just as a side note, Mrs. Eckley was my grade 6 teacher, so she definitely had an influence on me as well. So.
John Boris.
Hi, John.
Melanie, there's one thing that you haven't said, and you have good reason probably why you haven't talked about it. But this, I don't know why this myth isn't better known. And the myth is that you can win an election. I'd be better to say your party can win the election if you are in tune with the people that are there. And so that elections are actually never won except in for years and years where someplace where there's been a seat in an urban seat, not so much a rural one. But elections are lost. And whether you're gay or whether you're a woman or a man, it doesn't really matter. If you cannot give out at least your party, I'll say, because a lot of people think...
Question, John.
Okay. A lot of people think that you are going to be as important as you can get. And you are a perfect candidate. You'd be wonderful. Any party would want you. So that doesn't help. So how can you get elected? Because you cannot change anything in politics unless you have a seat in Ottawa. And if I had a seat in Ottawa, I'd be out standing up for many, many women's rights. So you wouldn't have to worry about that. Thank you.
Thanks, John. So the first question I'm going to address is how you can actually get elected and then if you can actually change things without actually having a seat in a formal political institution. Now, you mentioned, and I think you're correct when you say that elections sometimes aren't won, they're lost. But I would argue they're lost by the front runner, which means if you are well ahead in the polls and this is your election to lose, then it would be based on your own actions that you would lose that election. But we do have various local examples where candidates have built up a base of support over time, and you're right, it is mostly, I mean, the shortcut in Canadian elections is the party label. When people say that they vote for the person that's running in their riding, it's not true. They don't vote for the person who's in the riding. They vote for the party label that's attached to the person, people who are running in their riding, which, you know, explains a lot of the reason why perhaps women don't vote for women or visible minorities might not vote for a visible minority that represents them, looks a lot like them, I should say, or things like that. But elections can be won. The individual candidate does make a difference. It's not a huge difference, but it's a difference that's between 5 and 10%. Which means if you've got a very close competitive race with several parties, the candidate does matter. And the work with the election study team for 1988 and 1993, their main thesis was that the campaign mattered. And they demonstrated that, in fact, the campaign did matter. Tom Flanagan is very open about the fact at the Department of Political Science at the U of C that the Conservatives were in majority government territory according to their own internal polling until about 7 days before the actual election call, and there was several mistakes that they made, the child pornography release, you know, amongst many, many other things that, and there were other factors that they couldn't quite explain that just completely eroded their support and put us into a minority Liberal government territory. So I would argue that actually you can win and lose an election if you're on the ball and your main competitor starts making mistakes and you start doing the right things, that means that you are winning the election, I would argue. They're losing it too, but they're also winning it. And if you've got a competitive race, like we so rarely have in southern Alberta, you can actually see how individual bits make a difference. Now, can you make change in politics without having a seat in the House? I would argue that sometimes you can actually make better change outside of the formal political institution than you can inside. I wish our MLAs were still here from the Liberal Party provincially, because they, and actually anybody who's not a Tory in the Alberta legislature will tell you that as MLAs, based on the way that our provincial government is structured and run, they can't do much from inside the House. They can do some things, but they don't have the power that they would have if they were in government. And a backbench government MP will say that they don't have the power that to make change like they could if they had a cabinet seat. And we saw with Paul Martin and Jean Chrétien that Paul Martin clearly didn't think he could do what he needed to do to change things the way that he wanted to unless he was actually prime minister instead of the second in command. From my own experience, I know that particularly if you're working with a government that's not friendly to your issue, if you can get the public on side and do a lot of work with voters, with stakeholders who are interested in your particular issue, and you can mobilize people to start telling the government what they want done, you can make change without a seat. It's hard, but you can definitely change the political system without actually having a seat in Ottawa. Which is why it's important to have women's groups talking about women's issues, because that's how we'll make change on that front. But yeah.
Bob Anderson. Melanie, I can think of a lot of reasons for voting for you. But I want to raise a question. In your study and research, have you identified some issues around which women might be attracted into politics? Are there certain areas or issues that would draw women into the action of politics?
I think it's the same issues that get women involved into community organizations and into activist work. Things that surround their children, education, childcare, their own employment when they see injustice in that. The wonderful women from Women's Space probably will be able to give a significantly larger litany of women's issues that have women mobilized in the community and have them working and once you can actually get a political interface for those issues, it's the same thing, I think, that will get women involved in the formal political system. But it's the same thing that will get women involved generally, because there's one of the early mantras of the women's movement was that the personal is political. So what really affects you in your personal life can be politicized and can actually have a political solution to it and a political problem to it as well. So if we can find out what's getting women excited and active in their personal lives and in various other forms of public engagement that isn't necessarily formally political, and we can make that political, then I think that's how you get women involved as well.
Ed Bardock, I think you know my question, Melanie. Having moderated you at several political forums, mm-hmm. I admire your speaking ability, your ideas, and your passion. And I wonder if you're going to run again later, if you would consider two things. If you're going to stay in Alberta, switching parties so that we could get you elected, or else move to a different province where you have a hope better than a snowball in that place.
Well, Ed, like I said at the table as well, I'm not going to switch parties. For all intents and purposes, my blood is orange rather than red. So, I wasn't formally involved in the partisan political system until I actually got involved with New Democrats. And you can see once you actually get involved in a party that you become very partisan. And I'll admit that I very much am. I'm aware of my partisanship, and I keep it in my personal politics that I do for fun rather than my professional political science sort of thing. I think it's very important as a scholar to keep to know where my own ideological orientation and how that might affect my research. So I'm very aware from that in my vocational career, but I'm not going to switch parties simply to win. I would rather go on the strength of my ideas and the party's convictions than my desire to sit in some elected body. I'm going to have to move, probably, just to further my own career, but I've been told by the leader of the Provincial New Democrats that he's giving me a decade and then he wants me to take over the party leadership. So, yeah. We'll see. We'll see how that goes. Yeah. Maybe Quebec. We'll see. We'll see how that goes. But yeah.
I just wanted to thank you for running. We may not share the same color. But as someone who has run an election, do you feel that name recognition makes a difference when voting in a constituency that bases a lot of information on what they know about the person by their name?
I think that name recognition is crucial to any electoral success, particularly based on my experience in Lethbridge. I think that's what actually got the New Democrats' proportion of the vote to increase. I don't think it was accounted for all of the increase. I think there was other things going on, that we had a fantastic leader, that the campaign went well. But I think, and I've heard from particularly young people, that they knew me from the university, and particularly student government, that meant that they, you know, thought that I would do a good job at the federal level as well. And that because they knew the name, then they would translate that to a vote. And I think with things like signage and things like that, I mean, that's why we put up signs, right? I mean, if you don't know any of the candidates' names, you're probably likely to just not vote, period. If you know one or two of their names, then you're probably likely to go and vote, well, I know this person out of the list of four, so I will vote for the person that I know. And if there's actually a real race going on and you know more than one candidate, then I think it becomes more substantive. But name recognition is crucial, crucial, definitely.
Yeah, great. I'm Damien Dorfner. I want to thank you very much for speaking today. And as somebody from our age group, I'd like to... Oh, you're going to lift this up for me. Thank you. I'd like to know if we'd be better off tackling the problem of voter disengagement in our age group in males and females rather than just focusing on just the female issue. I know there is obviously a gap there between mm-hmm. males and females, but if you take into account how many people are actually voting, the actual number of people might not be that much, but I'm not sure if that's the case.
Yeah, it's definitely something that we need to tackle for both genders, but the point of my research is not that we only need to focus exclusively on one gender to the exclusion of the other, but that one behaves differently and we have one message that's sent out to young people isn't going to have the same resonance with both genders. We know that young men behave in a very similar way to past generations of men. So that is a pretty good indicator that we can use probably some more traditional ways of reaching voters that might tap into young men as well. It's interesting. I have friends of mine who, again, they're part of my ideological stripe, and most of them actually aren't, and they're very opinionated about politics, and yet they don't translate those opinions to things like a vote. And I was stunned when I found out that my most outspoken male friend about political issues, who harasses me constantly about being a New Democrat, didn't bother to cast a vote in the last federal election, nor in the last provincial election, and I don't know if he's ever actually voted, period. And yet he's very active and has an opinion and complains an awful lot about what's going on in politics. For women, it seems like there's a very distinct pattern that's going on with our generation of women, and so to me, I think one of the conclusions we can draw to remedy and bring up voter turnout is that we've got to have a tailored message that goes out to them. But definitely, the youth and disengagement is a problem, period, across the board. And it's an international problem as well. It's not just Canada. It's in all established democracies, and so it's something that internationally we could probably do a lot of work on.
Howard Forsyth. I've been doing quite a lot of reading lately, including going way back and looking over the... By way back, I mean when men were hunter-gatherers and when the society was hunter-gatherers, the men were the hunters and therefore the more active, and the women were the gatherers. And then coming up to feminism, which I've been in more or less, I've been around for 7 decades since I got my PhD, so I'm fairly mature. Feminism thing has achieved all kinds of things, but it isn't finished. You didn't say much about this, but there are a lot of ways in which we are not treating women as serious, mature people. And I want to touch finally something that I've really just discovered lately, but maybe all know about it. It used to be...
Howard, your question, please.
I've got to do this before I make it. It's going to be a good question, just a minute. It used to be that young people became mature at 19 or 20 and went on with their lives. Now adolescence is up to age 30. But the interesting question is, it's mostly men that we think of as being weird in that they're still adolescents until they're 30. Do you see anything in these kind of changes that is either positive or negative for your hope that women will take their place and will wake up and use the talents that are available in society?
I'll address the issue of feminism first and then talk about delayed adolescence, because that's a very important point, and I'd like to thank you for bringing that up, definitely. I have a fear when it comes to women and the women's movement, and my generation in particular. I will out myself as a feminist. I am. I work in a male-dominated profession. I know what it's like to be for women to be in the minority, and I know what it's like to be the only woman working in a group of men and how that works out. And I mean, I know that in a lot of circumstances that means that there's this tacit expectation that I have to be twice as good as my job as, you know, my colleagues. And lucky for me, I don't mind being twice as good, so I I do my work and I do it well. So, but when I hope none of my colleagues actually watch that, but I fear for my generation of women, because we think that we've got equity, we think that we have employment equity, we think that we have income equity. We think that we do have educational equity, but as my own research demonstrates, it doesn't mean the same thing for women as what it does for men. My generation of women, and for women who are coming after me, they'll say things like, we don't need feminism anymore because we've achieved everything. So what do we have to fight for? And I know what we have to fight for, which is why I'm still fighting for it. I fear that our daughters will come along and be aghast at us and ask us as their mothers, you know, 30, 40 years down the road, what did you do? There were so many things that you still had to work for, and your mothers and your grandmothers got us to such a good point, and then you just let it all slide. Now you've left us in such a horrible position. What did you do? And so either my generation has to have, of women has to have a complete awakening as to what their real situation is, or it's going to be our daughters who carry on with it. Now, the delayed adolescent point is, I think, a good one, because we don't know if we've got youth political disengagement simply because we just have different roles, that in order for us to be gainfully employed, realistically, we have to go into some form of post-secondary education, which means even according to the government, we still are, even if we are legally adults, we're still under the purview of things like our parents' income when it comes to financing as, you know, between the ages of 18 and 22. I don't know if it affects women differently than men. I know a lot of my peers really struggle with the idea of being in their 30s and establishing their career and what that means for having children, because we know, or we suspect, that our male peers aren't going to pick up the slack, and so either it's going to be things like childcare or our careers are going to suffer. I just don't know what that looks like, but I know that delayed adolescence is an important point, and how it actually manifests itself, I don't think we know quite yet. But that's a really unsatisfying answer. I'm sorry.
Melanie, Terry Shillington, thank you very much for your presentation. The conversation over lunch at our table just boiled, so you'd really raised a lot of issues for us. I'd like to ask about the Alberta factor. I think your research has been largely national, I gather, in scope, but is there a difference between political engagement in Alberta and in other provinces? And I guess a related question is, to what extent do the percentages shift when there's a competitive, would you relate it to a competitive political situation as opposed to one in which there's no suspense? Anyway.
Okay. So, we don't know if Albertans, we suspect that Albertans are more disengaged than other citizens of other provinces, but we don't know for sure because we don't have things like provincial election studies. And the reason why we can say so much about the federal about federal politics and federal political behavior in Canada is that every time there's an election campaign, we survey about 4,000 Canadians over the phone, several hundred a day during the whole course of the campaign, and we send out three waves of the same survey, so we gather a lot of data during election campaigns. We don't do that at the provincial level. I believe Manitoba is going to start, but it's definitely one of those things where this research naturally leads in a federal state to what's going on at the provincial level, and we just don't know, and there's really no way for us to get at that. My proposed doctoral research, I'm applying for a PhD to start in September 2006, and because of that I have to put in an application now to get funding from the federal government because universities don't have a lot of money to support people like me who choose to do academics as a vocation while we're still students. So I'm putting together my PhD proposal now, and I plan on getting as close as I possibly can, so looking at various engagement factors that we can kind of tap into that aren't necessarily that individual level sort of thing. So if we can look at things going on that are provincial and compare those provincial differences to other provinces and other states in the United States, you know, Australian subnational units, Germany, those whole sorts of things, hopefully that project will shed some light on it. It's intuitive to think that if you had a competitive election that people might engage a little bit more. But if you look at the federal election in 2000, where it was dubbed the election about nothing, and it was really more a strategic call because certain parties were doing well in the polls and thought that they could return a majority if they just held an election now if people didn't care what was going on, and it really wasn't about any issue or any scandal or anything like that. So 2000 was a very boring election. If you contrast that to 2004, it was, you know, the threat of a government change in the majority direction,